You ain't heard nothing yet.
Turn around, little
bitch. What
am I going to do?
Frankly, my dear,
I'm going to make him an offer.
You talking to me?
Try not to detain!
I don't know who you are.
Why so serious?
When I'm good, I'm very good.
Simple.
But when I'm bad, I'm better.
He's a liar!
Snap out of it!
If they call me Mr.
A boy's best friend is his mother.
You have no style.
You can bark all day, little dog.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Hello, and welcome back to the Tinsel Factory. My name is Caitlin, and I'm your host. Hope everybody had a great week. The studio party I talked about last week was super fun, and some of the orchestra from Oppenheimer was there, and they played pieces of the score, and that was really, really awesome. It was only like a fraction of the musicians I'm sure they used for the full score, but you would never know just the amount of like power and skill these musicians had was just insane. It was really, really cool. Free food and booze on a Tuesday. Always a good time. So that was a pretty cool experience. Probably the highlight of the month. I doubt anything that cool is going to happen in the next 7 days, but you never know. This week on Movie Theater Movie Reviews, we've got Imaginary. I went back to the movie theater for the first time in a couple of weeks for this trash. It's been a long time since I was angry that I sat through a movie because of its quality. I think the last one was Babylon, and that was like January of last year, I think. At least in a theater. I'm sure I've been angry home watching some garbage, but this is the first one I've seen in a theater in a while. The acting, save for the lead actress in this, was horrific. Dialogue was trash. Just a bad movie. If you're interested in it because of that guy that was in The Walking Dead and that one crime drama that had Michael Sheen as like low rent Hannibal Lecter, don't bother. He appears for some reason for like 30 minutes of it and then just disappears for the rest of the movie, basically. He pops up here and there, but it doesn't do anything with the plot. They could have just made everybody dead and made this woman a single mother, but for some reason they decided to just add random touring musician husband into the mix. It made no sense. It was stupid. It was clunky. They had no chemistry, the lead actress and the Walking Dead guy, no chemistry whatsoever. It was just painful to watch. And I know I hated this movie because I like rage looked up like who was responsible for this trash? Like who made this audacity of a film? The only reason I got a wide release is because, you know, content is light right now because of the strikes and, you know, all the stuff, you know, still trying to get everything back online with that. And there's not a lot of work right now. So there's not a lot of things getting made. So that's probably why this thing was allowed to get the release that it did. But yeah, I looked at the director. He's Katie Couric's nephew. So it's nice to see the Nepo babies really working hard for that foot in the door they got because Jesus Christ. Do not go see this movie. Do not go. Don't do it. Save yourself. It's too late for me. Life is short. Don't spend it watching Imaginary. I hated this. I can't say don't go see this hard enough. Don't do it. Not even if you like to watch shitty movies. Don't even go see it then. Don't waste your life. There's better crap than this crap. They didn't even make a good crap. They made it just, I need to stop. I will just rant on for 45 minutes about just how much I hated Imaginary. So for the Criterion pick of the week, we've got Spine number 1048, which is Dos Monjes, which is a film about the shared past of two monks told from each of their perspectives. So you hear one person's version of the events, and then you go back and you hear the second guy's version of events. And obviously there's things that are a little bit different because, you know, your memory is flawed. This is an early sound Mexican melodrama, and it's actually one of Scorsese's Film Foundation's restoration projects. So you will see little jumps here and there when it's clear they couldn't restore the picture, so they just kind of bridged it, and that's just the nature of films like this. But like 99.9% of it is completely restored, quite gorgeously, I might add. And I thought it's just a very visually striking film that experimented with the flashback and unreliable narrators and the expressionistic lighting outside of Germany at this time, because it would have been the early 30s. I think it was 1931. Rashomon tends to be the film that gets like the credit for doing the, you know, different people telling the same story from different perspectives. But this was like almost 20 years before Rashomon even came out. And I didn't even know about this film, never heard about this film. But it's definitely not a perfect execution of that style, but it's definitely a start. I thought it was really interesting. And from a film history standpoint like that, I think it is worth a watch. And now on to this week's topic. This week, it was 1999, and it was the best year ever. With that, let's take our places. It's showtime.
Step over the threshold. Welcome to Cairo Prison, my humble home.
You told me that you got it on a dick down in Phoenix.
No, well, I was mistaken.
You lied to me.
I lie to everybody. What makes you so special?
I am your sister.
Yes, well, that just makes you more gullible.
Jonathan, you stole it from a drunk at the local Casbah.
Picked his pocket, actually, so I don't think
Jonathan,
it's a very good idea.
Being so ridiculous. Now, what exactly is this man in prison for?
Well, this I did not know. But when I heard you were coming, I asked him that myself.
Yalla!
And what did he say?
He said he was just looking for a good time.
This is the man that you stole it from?
Yes, exactly. So why don't we just go sniff out Spot of Tiffin?
Who are you? And who's the broad?
Leading into our best year ever, in 1998, the president of the United States did not have sexual relations with that woman, but, you know, he did. Coincidentally, just 2 months later, Viagra hit the market. That had to be late night jokes, right? You got Leno and was Letterman on? I can't even, late 90s? I think so. Doing jokes about Viagra and the president. That had to be a thing. They're not that nuanced. Anyway, I just took my Ritalin, Rat Adderall, whatever hell it's called. It should be kicking in soon. Also, Google was founded. The Good Friday referendums were signed in Ireland, putting to bed years of turmoil. And the International Space Station began operations, and a recession struck most of Asia. When the clock struck January 1st, 1999, many people thought that this would be the last year of civilization. Rumors were swirling that the computers we as a society were relying on more and more each day would all malfunction when the year 2000 struck because the computers weren't programmed for that date change. Seems like an oversight if you ask me, but what do I know? I was 10. Also, not gonna lie, as an undiagnosed, anxiety-ridden individual who at 10 years old had unrestricted access to pretty much everything, so long as people weren't, you know, boning in something, I was fucking terrified of Y2K. I remember being super anxious about it because I had a little bout of technophobia, I think, slightly before this, because the computer kept crashing when I would open Windows in AOL, and I was terrified of, like, the computer breaking. I was terrified of people were on the computer. I have not told many people this, so I don't know why the candidness today, but I was terrified of the computer. I had just gotten over it, and then this was happening, and I was like, no, not again. I just got over my fear of the computer. I can't believe they didn't realize I was neurospicy. But what are you going to do? But yeah, so I don't remember this at all, but I've heard it independently from multiple sources that were there. When the clock apparently struck midnight on Y2K at my home, I picked up the phone. I heard a dial tone because nothing happened. Obviously, we're 25 years on almost. And then I went on to bed. I just went straight to bed. It's like, dial tone, everything will be fine. That was the gauge of societal okayness that I was using at 10 years old. I guess I just didn't know about time changes back then, or just thought like I had the crucial time zone that would decide how everything worked. You know, 10-year-old brains. I guess it just also didn't bother me that like whole places of the world had been in the year 2000 for several hours before it struck in California. I don't know. I'm on pills now, and the existential dread and fixation is far less now. I was also afraid of the asteroids because that was a big thing in 1998, but we're not going to get into that because we're talking about 1999 and my trauma from this year. So I'm probably going to cut a lot of that out. But yeah, this doesn't need to become my therapy session. So with this fear of a technological Armageddon weighing on people's minds, why not go out with a bang cinematically? Paramount, one of the studios who'd produced or distributed Titanic, had continued their era of hits since 1984. In 1994, it was purchased by Viacom and had just kept running. Titanic was 1997. It had made, I almost said, a boatload of money. It made a lot of money. But yeah, so they were still riding pretty high off of that. Major 1999 releases for Paramount included Runaway Bride, Sleepy Hollow, the South Park movie, and Angela's Ashes. that's a solid year for any studio to have. They'd be thrilled to have. But none of those films actually ended up in the top 10 or were nominated for Best Picture. So we're going to spend a little bit more time taking looks at the films and expanding upon the films that got a little bit more love than what Paramount put out that year. But just know Paramount was thriving. Since we last dealt with Warner Brothers, the studio had been purchased by Time Warner, who would own them until like 3 years ago, 2 years ago. This studio had a booming television sector, which was great for the studio at this time because their film record is a tad spotty throughout the late 80s into the 90s. One notable exception to this, however, was The Matrix, of course. The Wachowskis, a sibling director team, had written the script in the early 90s, and after years of shopping it around and development, they finally landed at Warner Brothers to shoot their revolutionary sci-fi flick, which they did in Sydney, Australia. The film popularized and invented several unique visual styles and angles and stuff like that, including bullet time, which is the name given for the type of shot that most famously, they use it in a couple of things, but most famously, you know, it's the Keanu Reeves like dodging the bullets as he's like arching his back, and it's like a 360 view almost, and you see the bullets like rippling through the air. That's bullet time, and obviously it's named after what the bullets look like when they're flying through the air. In the screenplay, the Wachowski actually described this look as liquid space, which I feel is a very good description for what that looks like. Shooting in Sydney allowed the Wachowskis distance from Warner Brothers, which ended up allowing them to thrive without the studio kind of breathing down their necks. It was the technological age. Obviously, there was internet and there was communication and there was email, but all of that stuff was still pretty slow compared to like what it is now. You can't just like jump on a FaceTime and scream at a director. Not that that's how that probably is happening somewhere, but you know, you couldn't do that then. You still had to like get somebody on the phone. So they had a lot more freedom to kind of experiment and try things. And Warner quickly realized that whatever the Wachowskis were doing down in Australia was great. So they gave them more shooting time. They threw some more money at it because they wanted a film that would at least compete with the film that everybody in town knew was going to be the biggest film of the year. We'll get to the minute. So they upped their game a little bit with this one. They bet everything on this one and it worked out for them. The Matrix released in March, 2 months before the said film that everyone knew was going to be the biggest of the year. It broke Easter weekend records upon its release. It was an almost instantaneous classic and is still a cultural staple to this day. If you see that shot, the, you know, the jump and the freeze and the rotating, you know that they're parodying The Matrix. Even if you've never seen it, you probably know that that's the thing from The Matrix. It's also, of course, spawned several sequels, including one that came out in just like 2-3 years ago. Warner also distributed The Green Mile in 1999, which was nominated for Best Picture. This film was based on a Stephen King serial novel, and the film told the story of a prison guard and the mysterious inmate he's charged to watch over before his execution. The film starred Tom Hanks, whose other major film that year, Toy Story 2, released on the exact same day as The Green Mile. Do I have to tell you which one came on top? Probably not. It was not this one, but The Green Mile was actually the number two film at the box office for 10 weeks, which is honestly impressive in its own right. Other Warner films from this year include The Iron Giants, which is still a beloved nostalgic film for millennials, Three Kings, and Any Given Sunday. 20th Century Fox had expanded massively in the last 15 years. They'd added four film divisions to the 20th Century brand, including Searchlight, which was their indie movie banner. 1999 would see the studio notably releasing a cult classic and the highest grossing film of the year, as well as a few other gems. There was Office Space, of course, Mike Judge's live action feature film directorial debut based on three animated shorts he'd made in the early 90s. Mike Judge came from animation, if you did not know that. To promote the film, the studio actually had a man live in a plexiglass box in Times Square for 5 days. How he went to the bathroom, I didn't look up because I didn't want to know. And this was streamed live on the internet as this man answered calls and emails from people who hated their jobs. This didn't help the film's box office, though. It actually bombed when it was initially released, but the film gained cult status not long after thanks to the emerging DVD market and just word of mouth. But, you know, I doubt 20th Century Fox cared too much about this failure because 3 months later, they were distributing their likely cash cow. George Lucas had started writing the scripts for the Star Wars prequels in 1994. Production in post had taken nearly 2 years and cost $115 million. But in May of 1999, it was finally showtime for The Phantom Menace. people were quivering with anticipation for the first Star Wars film in basically a generation. So much so that people were actually camping out in front of theaters for months in advance. This was before you could pick your seat at the theater. Or online ticketing. I don't think online ticketing was a thing. I don't think movietickets.com existed yet. Or Fandango or any of the others. Well, people were pretty split on the quality of the film when it ultimately released, and some weren't so sure about some of the, let's say, eclectic creative choices, but it was Star Wars, and it was far and away the biggest grossing film of the year. Other notable 1999 Fox films included Fight Club, which, like Office Space, was a film that found its audience more after the film's release. Fox had actually secured the book rights for $10,000, and while it had been number one at the box office its opening weekend, it had gotten decent reviews, the fall off was severe and left a lot to be desired. One of the execs at Fox actually got fired indirectly because of the failure of Fight Club. Of course, now it's considered one of, if not the quintessential David Fincher film, who of course has had a very long and storied career after Fight Club. The MCA heyday had ended in 1990 for Universal when it was sold to Matsushita briefly before being sold to Seagram's in 1999. The year prior, the studio had suffered a costly flop in the form of Babe, Pig in the City, which did so badly that several executives actually lost their jobs over it. This shift in the guard allowed a young director to get a green light for his 18-page treatment for a new Mummy film. The Mummy script that got through was at least the fourth attempt Universal had made or looked at or financed to attempt to revitalize the monster genre, which had put Universal on the map nearly 70 years prior. While considered a risky bet, all things considered, it would prove upon release that the Mummy was truly resurrected when the film, which came out just before Star Wars, like 2 weeks before, became the highest non-holiday May opening weekend of all time. It held that title for 2 weeks. Star Wars came out the week before Memorial Day and just raked in all the cash. The Mummy ended up, of course, spawning a franchise for Universal, including a spin-off series for the Scorpion King, which would be a character that was introduced in the sequel. Fun fact, the film's lead, Brendan Fraser, almost died while shooting his character's hanging scene in the film. I watch The Mummy at least 4 or 5 times a year, probably. I love The Mummy. It's just still a big nostalgia movie for a lot of people. Like the Alamo Drafthouse does a yearly Mummy like special screening. Like, this film is just as popular today as it was when it released 25 years ago, which just makes me nauseous to say because I'm so young. What a ride Disney has had in the last 15 years since our 1984 episode. Under Michael Eisner, the whole Disney brand has exploded, and it's when we find it in 1999, it's currently enjoying one of its most secure eras, often referred to as the Disney Renaissance. Their big animated release of 1999 was Tarzan, which featured Oscar-winning music by Phil Collins. The song You'll Be in My Heart was an instant staple of the radio, and the mixture of traditional animation and CGI was, at last, a more or less seamless image. It looked less funky, definitely better than the Black Cauldron, if nothing else. In addition to its animation work, the studio also had Buena Vista, which released more adult content, and now also the Pixar films. Buena Vista released one of the most iconic horror films in the last 30 years with The Sixth Sense. The film script was bought on spec, meaning writer and soon-to-be director M. Night Shyamalan had sent it to studios without a deal and ended up getting quite the chunk of change for it. That pittance, in comparison to what he'd make later, ended up being more than worth it, as Sixth Sense both thrilled and traumatized a generation of audience goers, so much so it was nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars, and to this day, I See Dead People is an iconic film line. For better or worse, mostly better because I want to be positive, The Sixth Sense launched Shyamalan's film career, cementing him as a modern master of suspense, and his twists legendary until they weren't. But that's not a 1999 issue. Under Buena Vista, Disney also released The Insider, which was another Best Picture nominee for 1999. It was based on a controversial 60-minute segment about a whistleblower on the tobacco industry. They also released Toy Story 2, which I mentioned a little bit earlier, which is arguably one of the best sequels of all time, and one of the few instances where a sequel bypasses the origin in quality. I'll say I don't feel like that's that controversial of a statement. Toy Story 2 is just fundamentally better. But yeah, Disney had a good 1999. Their new kind of rival, kind of not, DreamWorks was a newish studio founded by Steven Spielberg, former Disney employee David Katzenberg, and David Geffen. And they would actually win the biggest prize of the year in 1999, thanks to their film American Beauty. American Beauty is a pitch black comedy about a middle-aged man who obsesses over his teenage daughter's friend while having just a whole ass midlife crisis. Does not age well considering who plays the father, with Kevin Fisher. But this movie came out about 20 years before we knew he was a sex pest. It's a rough watch seeing it now versus the first time I saw it back in college. You're just like, oh, he's kind of a creepy man, versus watching him be creepy and realizing he is, in fact, a creepy man. American Beauty was originally written as a play inspired by the Long Island Lolita case of the early 1990s. If you don't know what that is, to paraphrase wildly, a young woman was groomed by a much older married man, shit got weird, and the teenage girl tried to kill the married man's wife. It was a whole thing. It was like a big news thing. And yes, I was allowed to watch that on the news. Did I understand what was happening? No. Was I allowed to watch it? Yes. The end product, of course, was American Beauty, which was a sleeper hit that took many people by surprise, as DreamWorks, the animation side at least, which was still a part of the live action sector they would split a few years later, was busy having a turf war with Katzenberg's former employer Disney and their collaboration with the animation company Pixar. We're not going into Miramax too deeply because screw Harvey Weinstein, but the studio, fresh off its controversial Shakespeare in Love win from the year before, turned out another Oscar-nominated film, The Awards Bait, Cider House Rules. It was based on a novel. It's about a young man who lives in a World War II-era orphanage that's run by a doctor, and it's like his journey, like trying to leave the orphanage and getting out of the orphanage. It's Oscar bait personified. It's World War II. It's sad. It's melancholy. There's sad boys. It's big time Oscar bait. So in addition to all of these studio hits, the year had actually started out with a bang from an unexpected place. The Blair Witch Project had premiered at midnight at the Sundance Film Festival back in January and had shocked and thrilled audiences, with many people thinking that the events depicted in the film were real, mostly because they said they were. The film is actually a found footage horror picture about a trio of friends who go into the woods to make a documentary about a small town's legend, and was one of the first to be marketed primarily using the internet. 6 months before this film came out at Sundance, so about a year before it was released to everyone wide, the film's official website launched and featured faux police reports as well as interviews about the quote-unquote missing students, which caused the early internet to work themselves up into a tizzy, and everyone was arguing as to whether or not this was a real thing. I remember my parents talking about this, like, it's not real, right? Well, no, they say it's real, so it must be real. Why? They're not allowed to lie. Of course they were. It's a movie. And of course, all of this was by design. It was to get people talking. It's a genius marketing campaign. And the filmmakers just completely stoked those flames. They're like, Fallon is crazy, man. Like, look what happened to these poor people. They're missing and there's a witch and all this shit. USA Today would later declare that The Blair Witch Project was the first film to quote unquote go viral. And by the time it was released wide in July of 1999, it was a full blown phenomenon. Internationally, Christopher Nolan made his first feature film debut in 1999 with his black and white thriller Following, which I talked about a couple of months ago. There was also Run Lola Run, which was a German action time-bending film. This also debuted, I think this is actually a 98 film, but it debuted in the US in 1999 and just ran wild. It was a very, very popular film. It's fantastic, actually. So why was 1999 the best year ever? This is just another ridiculously stacked year. Other films I didn't have time for include a cavalcade of teen films: Varsity Blues, She's All That, Cruel Intentions, American Pie, 10 Things I Hate About You, all 1999. All films you've probably seen, if not at least heard of. These films, you know, were about teenagers. They were newer actors, significantly cheaper to produce than the big budget boys we've been primarily talking about all episode. So they could be churned out pretty quickly. It wasn't difficult to make your money back. And these films would also provide an avenue for like television actors to be able to launch their own film careers. At this point, you know, film and TV were still very different things. There wasn't a lot of going back and forth, and film was always like the preferred one. If you could be a movie star, it's better to be a movie star than a TV star. So many of them, you know, would take pay cuts or make a little bit less money to do a teen film, because that meant they might be able to start making movie star money. Outside of the more commercial fare of teen films, there were films like Election and Rushmore. Of course, those two films came out in the same year. And there was also The Virgin Suicides. The directors of all three of these films, Alexander Payne, Wes Anderson, and Sofia Coppola, still have very prevalent careers today. In fact, all three of them released highly praised films last year. Alexander Payne did The Holdovers, Wes Anderson did the short Henry Sugar, and Sofia Coppola did Priscilla. And the boys had films that were nominated for Oscars and won. The Holdovers won for Best Supporting Actress, and Wes Anderson's short won the Oscar for Best Short. He was not there. What are you going to do? Well, these three films, Election, Rushmore, Virgin Suicides, they've all found their audiences in the ensuing years. In 1999, they actually did underperform. They likely had their R ratings to thank for that. They weren't darkly sexy like Cruel Intentions or gross out and horny like American Pie, which made them a little bit of a harder sell. But, you know, they found their eyes, and they're probably arguably more popular than a few of the ones I mentioned there that made like a lot more money back in 1999. But that doesn't necessarily mean anything. 1999 was the apex of the teen movie trend, as the kids of the 90s they were made for eventually grew up and out of high school. And you don't really see this like robust amount of teen movies really past this point. 1999 is also the first major year where we see the internet providing a film with its audience, and where for the first time film lovers from all over the world could amass online to pick apart the quote-unquote messages of films like The Matrix or Fight Club. And 25 years later, people are still talking about The Matrix and Fight Club and what does it mean and what was the message and what was this and what was that. And, like, it's still happening. It has never stopped. He also got Me Too'd, but Henry Knowles of Ain't It Cool News, which was a website, well, I think it's still a website, that had been devoted to movie and pop culture news, began its major influence on the film industry around this time. It was probably a couple years before that, actually, because it had something to do with one of the Batman and Robin films. I'm blanking on the specifics. But for a brief moment, a film would sink or swim based on Knowles' reviews and articles. He was just some online guy that gained prevalence. It's where people went for movie news, because there weren't a lot of other places to do that in 1999. So being first was a big, big one-up for back then, especially for internet stuff. 1999 had just diversity in the types of films that started with these crazy good screenplays. Like, all these are really intelligently written as well. And just, like, who the story is about. You had, like, Neglected Toys. You had Imaginary Anarchists. Horny Suburban Dads. Sociopathic Teens. You had The Works. This was also a year that saw some of the best directors in the business just really strutting their stuff. We've got Nolan, we've got Anderson, we've got Payne, we've got Fincher, we've got a Coppola. We got the final Stanley Kubrick film with Eyes Wide Shut. Like, this is just a stacked, stacked year. You'd still, like, name these directors, well, Kubrick's dead, as, like, top directors today. These are still, like, the people. Maybe 1999 was the best year ever, because maybe whether some people believed it, some people they didn't believe it, thought it was stupid. Maybe it was just that back of the mind fear that maybe the world might end. And everyone took their maybe final last year on this earth just making really good movies. The studios had let their directors run wild in a way that hasn't really been seen since on this large of a scale. Maybe that's why so many of these films found their popularity later. It just took so long for people to fully process the extent of the films that were released in this year alone. They're so eclectic, and there was just too much content, and the internet didn't exist, so you just had to kind of like find it in the newspaper, at the movie theater, or in your local rental place. Like, there was starting to become an internet place for people to go, a database, if you will, or Ain't It Cool News, but people were still trying to, there wasn't really a cohesive way to find that back in 1999. In the last 25 years, the film industry has grown in some ways, but it has shrunk in many others, namely the screens, but that's a separate issue. And 1999 just was the apex of just making cool, big movies. CGI in 1999 was arguably at its most balanced with practical effects. People were thrilled by the fantastic things they saw here and there in a film, and Hollywood, as always, learned the wrong lesson and just started, you know, inundating us with CGI stuff until everyone just said, no, thank you. Like what? In the last like 3 to 5 years, everyone's like, oh, I'm probably okay with not a lot of this. But, you know, it was balanced back in 99, so maybe revert back to that. Movies had to reach a plethora of audiences back in 1999 to make their money back. Box office was the most reliable way to do this at the time, and therefore the studios had to try pretty hard to get people to go see movies. They were trying much harder and spending way more money, or at least it feels like they did, to get people to go see movies. That trying from 1999 is just gone now. Now it just feels like disinterested desperation. Like, please go, but we're also not gonna, like, please, 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 please go. But we're also not gonna, like, give you a reason to go. How about a weird popcorn bucket? 1999 was also the pre-mergers for several of these studios. It was one of the last times before everything kind of started getting slammed together. Universal would change hands at least 3 more times. Fox would merge with Disney. Warner Brothers was acquired by another company. Who the hell knows what's going on at Paramount this right now? In 1999, we were still 7 years away from streaming, which of course would change everything. Arguably not for the better. But right now, it was 1999, and it was the best year ever.
What do you want me to do? You just want me to hit you?
Come on. Do me this one favor.
Why?
Why? I don't know why. I don't know. Never been in a fight. You?
No, but that's a good thing.
No, it is not. How much can you know about yourself if you've never been in a fight? I don't want to die without any scars. So come on, hit me before I lose my nerve.
Oh, God. This is crazy.
So go crazy. Let her rip.
Hey, I don't know about this.
I don't either. Who gives a shit? No one's watching. What do you care?
Wait, what? This is crazy. You want me to hit you?
That's right.
What, like in the face?
Surprise me.
And that's going to do it for this week. If there's anything you'd like me to cover in the future, please reach out on social media, where I also post photos for each episode. I will swear I will get them out this weekend. At Tinsel Factory Pod on Instagram, on Facebook at The Tinsel Factory, or you can always email me at tinselfactorypod@gmail.com. I've got a Letterboxd account which features my watch lists, film diary, and recommended viewing for this episode. You can check it out at the link in the show notes. That I keep track of because that I actually like doing. I really don't like social media, but it is a necessary evil. I'm relying on word of mouth to get this podcast out there, so if you could please rate, review, and subscribe so other people can find this podcast, that would be a huge help. In order to keep making the podcast, I've also set up a support page, the link of which you can find in the show notes. If you'd like to help out in any way, I very much appreciate it. I've also got the Buy Me a Coffee. I think I post-made it this morning because I wanted a breakfast burrito and I had no ingredients. Namely, I didn't have tortillas. I've also got merch. Check it out at the link in the show notes. It is a 5-Sunday month, so I will be dark next week. But next month, we're going to take a look at the worst director, possibly directors, trying to figure out how many sources I can get that have ever lived. Kind of. Thanks again for listening. And until next time, that's a wrap.